You're listening to The Record. I'm Arwen Nix. When you think of economics, you may just think numbers. But economics drive human behavior, and human behavior drives the economy. That's the argument economist Stephen Levitt and journalist Stephen J. Dubner have made in their best-selling books, Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics. And that little bit of music is the theme from their podcast, where they tackle, well, the economy.
Is it possible that we'd all be better off if we could think like a child? Why do we do this, teach our kids a second language? Now, the answer might seem obvious. Like all education, it stretches your brain on any number of dimensions. But let's try to quantify it a bit more than that. All right, let me be clear. I don't actually want to kill anyone, and I don't endorse the idea of wanting to kill anyone. But if I did, and if I were looking for a way to do it and get away with it, how would I do it? I'd wait till they were outside, walking down the street, maybe crossing at the light, and then I'd run them over in my car.
So that's Stephen J. Dubner, the host of the Freakonomics podcast. Those questions may not seem like your standard econ questions, but they really are. Should we think more like children? Is learning a language worth it? What is the perfect crime? Questions and answers weren't enough, which is the impetus for their latest work, Think Like a Freak, a book in which these two men offer to help the rest of us retrain our brains. And they're both here with me now to talk more about that. Hi, guys.
Hey, Arwen. How are you?
Thanks for being here. So I want to start with the basics. How does one think like a freak?
So it's not so hard. What this book is kind of a collection of stories, like we like to do, because we like to tell stories, that illustrate sort of easy behaviors, like almost like parables or principles that really we think or hope anyone can do if they want to just think a bit more creatively or productively or rationally. And it was really inspired by a lot of people writing us with problems they wanted solved and questions they wanted answered. And we couldn't address them all. It's hard to solve problems and answer, you know, they're hard questions. So we thought if we could deputize the entire world, if whoever wants to think like this, that's why we wanted to write this book. So there are things like learning to say, I don't know, which as obvious as it may seem is really hard. And in a lot of areas, business and politics, nobody ever admits they don't know something. So learn to acknowledge what you don't know so you can figure out how to go find it and so on, or find someone who knows. A lot of what we write is in retrospect, seemingly pretty simple and obvious. The big question is why so few people think like this? And that's what we really explore, is what are the incentives that keep people from thinking in a way that kind of helps themselves most and helps other people so much.
Well, and I really enjoyed the chapter that you have on incentives and some of the stories that you told there. But give me one example of someone thinking like a freak. What's a parable that you can share?
I think one of the best examples in the book is this guy, Takuru Kobayashi, who is known for being a competitive eater. And he made his fame at the Coney Island hot dog 4th of July festival. And he was an unknown, and he thought like a freak in the sense that this was a sport, if you want to call it a sport, that was dominated by really big guys whose manner of training was figuring out how to stretch their stomach, how to cram as many hot dogs in as possible. But Kobe, who's a friend of ours, he thought about things completely differently, an econ major in college. And he shifted the frame. And the question he asked was not, how can I stuff as many hot dogs into myself as possible? He said, if I take one hot dog, what's the quickest way to get it into my stomach? Okay. And it turned out that the real constraint wasn't how big your stomach was. It was how fast you could get stuff in. And so he completely changed the technology and the technique for eating hot dogs. Instead of eating, everyone else ate hot dogs as the exact extension of everyday eating. They took the hot dog and the bun and they ate it bite by bite by bite. What he did is he separated the bun and the hot dog. And he did this all through experimentation and very careful kind of economic thinking. And then he realized if I rip the hot dog in half, I can jam both. So only the dog, no bun, I can rip the hot dog in half, which has come to be known as a Solomon after King Solomon ripping the baby in half. And he could basically just slurp the hot dog part down. And then with the bun, it's incredibly hard to eat these buns. They dry up your mouth. And apparently there's a hot dog. If you can eat two hot dog buns without any water.
Yeah, this is a good bar bet. If you ever really want to win a bar bet, you just go to a bar with a bag of hot dog buns, which is fun in and of itself. And then you put two on the bar and say to somebody, I bet you can't eat two hot dog buns in a minute with no beverage. And they're like, come on, how hard can that be? They're just little hot dog buns. And the first one actually goes down pretty well. And then you might need to have like medical standby because people can choke and die. You don't want to encourage that. But yeah, the second one. So it's like the saltine challenge but with hot dog buns. So Kobe realized similarly with the hot dog bun, like Levitt said, the dog goes down relatively easy because it's so slick and dense. But the bun was actually harder. So then he started dipping the bun in water and squeezing the excess water out and then popping it in like this big bun ball. And not only did it go down easier, but if he soaked the bun in warm water, the warm water actually helped all the swallowing muscles and the digestion. And he didn't then have to stop to drink afterwards like all the other guys do. So everything he was doing was making his process a little bit faster, so much so that when he finally competed, when he trained and competed, he doubled the world record first time out, which is nuts. Nobody doubles any world record ever.
50 hot dogs in 12 minutes. Yeah. This is a serious world record.
Feeling a little nauseous just hearing story, but I think it's a really good example of something else you get to in the book, which is changing the question that you ask. He, in competitive eating, rather than saying, how can I grow my stomach the biggest, decided to ask a new question, which seems important. And I really enjoyed that part of the book. But I want to go back to I don't know. So you talk about I don't know being the hardest words for us to say, the three hardest words to say. What evidence do you have that people have trouble saying I don't know?
We went through the presidential debates and all the presidential debates that had happened that had ever been televised. And I think I don't know had been said
once or twice, but not even in the context of what we're talking about. Yeah.
The only time the words,
like, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're an idiot. That was the way they
said it. Literally,
or I don't know what my opponent is thinking.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So literally in 40 years of presidential debates, a president has never to any question responded, I don't know.
Right.
And I think that's the indication of what we're
talking about. And the idea, we're not encouraging people just like embrace ignorance. That's the opposite of it. But the idea is that if you want to solve a problem, whether it's big, you know, poverty, famine, whatever, pretending you know the answer can be really bad because then you go off and do the thing that you think is going to work without any data, without any real intuition for what's going on the ground or what the root cause of the problem is. And then you waste time, waste money, and most of all, you waste optimism. I mean, I think that's the really hard part. Like when you look at situations now, environmental issues or societal political issues, when people rush off and are so sure they know the solution, they try to get everybody on board, and then they kind of halfway do, then they do their thing and it doesn't work, that really burns up a lot of goodwill. And that's the danger. I think it'd be better if people could take a step back and acknowledge, you know, this is a big problem. We understand that. What's the cause? What's the solution? We don't know it yet. So let's work really hard to find out. But most people like to charge off with what their, you know, kind of gut tells them.
So, again, explain to me then the reward of saying, I don't know.
The reward to saying, I don't know, is that you actually have the opportunity to learn the truth eventually. When you pretend to know the answer and you say to your colleagues, you know the answer, oh, we should be doing this, should be doing that, then you'll never experiment, you'll never try the thing, you'll never go gather the data that will allow you to really learn. In the short run, you may pay a price, right? You may, especially in a culture that's not used to people saying, I don't know, you run the risk that you'll be viewed as ignorant or unqualified. But I think that it's the perception of cost. So, I mean, one thing, look, we're into experimentation. We believe experimentation is the way to learn. I would challenge anyone who works to, in the next week, find an opportunity where they really don't know and to just once say, I don't know, but I'll try and find out the answer and see whether it leads to all of the catastrophic outcomes that would seem to be implied by the fear that people in business have.
So you're arguing that people will probably not get fired if they say, I don't know.
No, we can't make that argument. If they do, we don't want them blaming us. No, it's a really good question, though, because and a lot of what we write about in this book is the kind of balance or maybe friction between personal incentives and public incentives. Like a lot of things. There's this general idea that we all like to do things that are good for society. And that's as human, you know, within the realm of humankind, that's a fantastic idea. It's really nice, the idea that humans are cooperative and like to generally help each other and help society. But you also have to be realistic and realize that when people have a strong private incentive to do what's best for them, even if it's not good for the greater good, they're probably going to do that if they can get away with it. It doesn't make them bad people. That's just the way humans work. But you have to recognize that so you don't allow those private incentives to hurt the public good. You know, we have this kind of small, silly example in the book of a penalty kick in soccer, where if you really care about winning the match for your club, you might consider going right down the middle with your kick, because goalkeepers almost always jump left or right. So the strong public incentive, if you want to win, is to go center. The private incentive, however, is if you go center and the keeper stops it, you look like such an idiot that you're scared. And so you do the traditional thing. So we argue that in that small example, but in the broader scheme, that sometimes in life going straight down the middle is like the boldest move of all. It incurs some personal risk, and therefore it takes some boldness. But if you really want to help people or solve a problem, it can be a great way to think.
So you have the data, the research that you've done on I don't know, being tough to say, but having a great reward. How has that changed your own relationship with those words?
I don't know.
As an academic, so academics are different. I think the academics will say, well, we say I don't know all the time, because that is the premise of all of science and social science, is that there's these incredible problems out there that need to be solved, and you know you don't know the answers. And so for me, it was really when I came to businesses that it was so – the only reason I even was able to observe how hard it was to say I don't know is because I kept on expecting at every turn people to say I don't know, which was such a part of the dialogue that I had on campus. So yeah. For me, it was
And look, I'm a journalist. The presumption is you find people and ask them questions, which is, you know, the implied is that if I knew everything you could tell me, obviously I wouldn't have to be here asking you. But like, it's funny, the clips you played at the top of our podcast, it's like I asked some pretty ridiculous sounding questions. And part of it is just getting over the fear of sounding like, you know, a child or irrelevant or irreverent. And but I find it, I mean, look, it's the reason I wanted to be a writer since the time I was a kid. You like walk up to someone with a notepad and that's all you need. And it's a license to like totally invade their brain and ask them anything you want and ask them to explain all these things you don't know. And it's a license to really acknowledge it. Like, I don't know how you do this. Can you explain it for me? You find that people are generally really receptive to that, in part because we're all narcissists and we like to talk about what we do.
Stephen Levitt is the William B. Ogden Distinguished Service Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. And Stephen J. Dubner is an award-winning journalist and TV and radio personality. And with their powers combined, they are Freakonomics. Their latest book is called Think Like a Freak. So moving on from not knowing, you tell a story about the value of experiments and a company that refused to experiment, this one that would not advertise in some markets. Will you just tell me that story?
Sure. So earlier in the interview, I talked about how we were anointed business experts when really we didn't know anything. And I showed up at one of the first companies, and their big issue was in they didn't know if their advertising worked or not, and they had just hired some consultants who had economic consultants, highly paid economic consultants, not me. And they had done an analysis which suggested that their national TV advertising was maybe five times as productive in a return on investment perspective as were their the inserts that they put into the Sunday newspaper, which everyone has seen. They were a retail company. And so they had just shifted hundreds of millions, I think $500 million extra into TV ads as a result of this analysis. But I was highly suspicious because it's really hard to ever figure out what advertising works and which one works better. And so I asked them some questions. Well, you know, how often do you put these newspaper inserts into the newspaper? And they beamed with pride and they said they put a newspaper insert into every major market in America for the last 20 years every weekend. And as an empiricist, you say, well, how in the world could you ever know whether this worked if you've done the exact same thing in every market for the last 20 years? I mean, what's your comparison, your counterfactual? And I said, well, I suppose you also put the TV ads out every week in every market as well. And they said, oh, no, we only advertise three times a year on TV. We do a really big push before Father's Day, and then we do a bunch of ads right before Black Friday, and then we do a bunch of ads right before Christmas. Okay, so lo and behold, every single time this company advertises on TV, in the next few days, their sales skyrocket. Okay? And that's exactly what the economists, by using a technique we called regressions, which are correlations, had decided that their TV ads were so incredibly effective. But they had been completely confused. They had the causality going the other way. These people were advertising because they knew they were about to sell stuff, not selling stuff necessarily because they were about to advertise. It may be that the advertising worked, and maybe it didn't. So I looked at the data. It wasn't at all clear that the advertising, the analysis the other firm had done had been good. And I said, I think based on the evidence you have, you really can't know whether your advertising works. And they said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, you should just do an experiment. Okay, let's start with the local newspaper inserts. I've done a power analysis, and if you will just give me 40 markets out of your 240, I can go through and I'll randomize 20 of them, and we'll just completely stop all the newspaper inserts. And then in a few months, we'll look at the sales and the ones where we stopped the inserts versus the ones we didn't, and we'll see what happens to your sales. And they said to me, "Are you crazy? We can't not do the newspaper inserts. The sales, you know, the CEO will kill us." And then they said one time there was a story of one of their summer interns who had been an MBA, and I think it was in Pittsburgh, and he had just been terrible at doing his job, part of which was to buy these inserts. And so they said, you know, this guy just totally forgot for a big chunk of Pittsburgh to do the ads. And when the salespeople found out what had happened, you know, we were almost fired. We had to go explain to the CEO and it was horrible. You know, so we can't not do these ads. And so jokingly I said to them, Well, did you hire that summer intern afterwards? And they said, no, why would we do that? He was terrible. I said, well, at least he was terrible in the way that allows you to figure out whether you're advertising. Where I said, what happened to your sales in Pittsburgh when you didn't have any inserts for 3 months? And they looked around the room and they said, we don't know. Never thought to look at that. That's such a great idea. And so they went back and looked at the data and they called me and said, you won't believe it, but we see no impact whatsoever on our sales in Pittsburgh when we didn't do the newspaper ads. I said, wow, that's really amazing. So when should we do the randomization? When can we start on the study where we take the 20 cities and we don't do any newspaper inserts? I said, are you crazy? We can't not do newspaper inserts. The CEO would kill us. So even though the one piece of evidence they had ever by accident happened to gather suggested that these, you know, maybe the $1 billion they were spending a year on newspaper inserts weren't working, they continued because of fear, the fear of kicking up the middle in the example of the soccer game. They refused to even try to find out the answer.
So we need control. We need to be able to understand. We need data. But our lives as human beings are not laboratories. So how do we take that knowledge, knowing our needs, and apply it to our individual lives?
Yeah, I think the value of experimentation is higher the more complex the world you live in. Because in a complex world, you can't possibly hope through intuition or, you know, introspection to sort out all of the factors that are causing something to happen or another. Okay, but on the other hand, the beauty of experimentation, it's like a coin toss. If you say, I don't know whether, say you want to know whether smiling makes you feel better or whether you feel better because you smile. Okay, every morning you flip a coin. Okay, if it comes up heads, you say, I'm going to consciously smile a whole lot today. And if it comes up tails, I'm not. And then you record at the end of the day whether you had a good day or a bad day. I mean, that's an example, a very silly example of how in experimentation, in a few months later, you could tally up the data and say, you know, actually, the days when I smiled were much better than the days when I didn't smile. And it would be a very hard thing to find out in other ways because the world is so complex and every day is so different. I mean, it's a completely trivial example, but it's really that kind of thought, how can I figure out by doing something whether I'm making the right choices a month from now, a year from now? And so in setting up how you change things, to change them in ways that provide feedback, because really experimentation is the ultimate in feedback, and you cannot learn without feedback, and you can get feedback without experimentation, and we encourage people to get feedback however they can, but experimentation is really the gold standard of feedback.
I don't remember which one of your books it's in, but you talk about naming and the social scientist who named one of his children Winner and the other Loser.
Oh, that wasn't... Yeah, that was that guy wasn't a social scientist. That was just
a
regular
guy.
Turned
out to be an excellent social scientist.
Well, he did, accidentally, yeah. So, yeah, a lot about baby names, Winner and Loser. And Winner turned out to be like a career criminal. Mm-hmm. And Loser turned out to be this guy who did great, got a good education, maybe a little military, I can't remember now, and then became a very well-regarded detective in the New York Police Department. But he had this name, Loser, so he had to, people had to call him Lou, which made people think for years that he was a lieutenant, which he wasn't, but it was better than being called Loser. But I think the guy, the social scientist you're thinking about, is this guy named Dalton Conley, who is a, I think, a sociologist at NYU, and he named his kids E, the letter E.
That's it.
That's the girl. And Yo, the boy. And then they also had, like, Yo especially had, like, 12 more names. Yo, Augustus, Knuckles, Weisenheimer, on and on and on. And so we wrote about them in the first book. And then a couple of years ago, we did a podcast on names, baby names, and the impact, which we argue is very little. So that's really the thrust of the argument we make, is that the name you get, a lot of, it's very easy to think. I mean, this is kind of what Lev was talking about with the simple experiment and the assumptions that go with it. So it's really easy to assume if you have a crazy or weird or unlikable or unusual name, it's easy to assume that's really going to hurt you in life. And the data shows that that's not true. Okay. And that's the argument we make. Here's the weird part, though. Even though we spelled that out as incredibly straightforwardly as we could in the first book, Freakonomics, most people still think exactly the opposite. They're always writing, yeah, you know, Freakonomics made the argument that your name really matters, where we said exactly the opposite. So to me, what's most interesting about that is either, okay, either people are kind of casual readers or we're terrible writers, both of which may be true, or it just may be that that's one of those kind of beliefs, those assumptions or preconceptions, the kind that we all have a million of. And even if you read some evidence to the contrary, we kind of go with what we thought before we read the evidence. And that's in this case, there's no harm in that. It doesn't really matter. But in some cases, there is a lot of harm, because when people hold strong priors or preconceptions, they tend to seek out evidence that confirms that further rather than like informing them further. So
that's wouldn't you say if someone got named Arwen, their life was pretty much doomed?
I would say if someone got named Arwen, there is just no end to how great life could be.
Oh, wow. See, you guys are confusing right there, since that's the argument.
That is
okay,
true.
So what is the lesson you've learned since you've both set out on your path as freakonomicists that's the hardest for you to put into practice? Stephen Dubner, you first.
I really like economics a lot, and I've learned a great deal about various parts of economics from working with Levitt over these past 10 years. But I particularly, the way I got into economics was through what's generally called behavioral economics. So it's some economics with a bunch of psychology in it. And I think that the psychology part is hugely important, and that it's easy to put a model, some of the models that economics brings, to describe human life. And it's very appealing to work with big data sets and to discover what the aggregate meaning is. That said, I think there are a lot of pieces of human life and human behavior that are not described fully through economics and statistical aggregation. So to me, the big challenge is using data in a way that's helpful, that you can describe the whole thing while acknowledging, and this is to me the kind of where I want to go in my future writing, is while acknowledging that 10 different humans can easily have 10 different sets of preferences, whether it's about political stuff, religious stuff, social, cultural, whatever. And to me, what I would like to see is a world where people acknowledge that simple fact that your preferences may be very different than mine, from mine, and yet that doesn't necessarily make you wrong or an idiot or someone I can't do business with or life with or be friends with. That's the troubling part to me, is that we've reached a kind of point in the culture where everybody's shouting at everybody about these issues that they believe in, but they're not really trying to persuade. They're not trying to compromise. They're not really even trying to help. They're just trying to show that they're right. And that bothers me. So that's kind of the, we're thinking like a freak, I hope for me can be helpful, because you understand why people believe as they do, behave as they do, and that it doesn't make them wrong or stupid if they have very different sets of preferences than you. The challenge is to figure out how to acknowledge the different preferences and create a solution that allows different people to get to create some kind of tide that lifts all boats. That is probably close to impossible. But that's
very optimistic.
It's way too optimistic. But that's what I'm, that's what I'd like to do or see.
And what about you?
Well, I'm not going to say anything quite as profound as Stephen is. This is not difficult for me, but it was an interesting insight. And after we wrote the books, I didn't really change. I had the same stupid ideas and nonsensical thoughts, but everybody started acting like everything I said was so smart and so interesting. And it taught me a lot about power and the importance of power and the importance of people who have power to recognize and try to counteract that. I mean, I know people who've been close to the President Obama, and the thing that happens is no one will tell the president the truth. And the president feels all powerful because the president is somewhat close to being all powerful. And it ends up being incredibly distorting to your view of the world when you come to believe that you have answers. And it's also very interesting in interpersonal relationships, say with students or people who defer to you and stop thinking because of that. So to me, that's just been power is not a part. Economics doesn't even think about power, but it's a little bit parallel to what Dubner's saying about what's left out of economics. And I've come to appreciate power and very much enjoyed trying hard to reverse power. So I do a lot. I try to do things to put myself into situations where I have no power so I can experience what I think is a really important feeling, which is understanding being on the other side of things.
Fighting off the emperor has no clothes
exactly.
Kind of idea.
Yeah.
So you faced a fair bit of controversy with some of the topics you guys have looked at, climate change, crime rates, and abortion being legalized. Is there any question that you're afraid to take on?
I can't think of any. Can't think of anything that we've wanted to do, to write, or talk about. Because honestly, the approach that we take is, I think, pretty well suited to any topic, because it's an approach. It's not like a topic-driven, methodology. I'm trying to think.
I think the closest. So we have taken on a lot of issues of race, but those are the ones that scare me the most. Like, I'm not afraid of arguing with people about climate change, because we know we're right on climate change, so we're not that concerned about it. But race is so emotional and highly charged, we've written a ton about race, but I think that's where I'm most frightened of being misperceived, because I think the cost of misperception.
Well, not only the cost, race, but the level at which an argument can be extrapolated is low.
Yeah, because some of the work we did on abortion and crime was intentionally and blatantly misinterpreted by some to have an important racist component to it. But look, it was so obvious to anyone who looked at the arguments and what we wrote and the fact that wasn't what we were doing. But I think that's the one issue that strikes fear into my heart. Mm. But still, I think it's important as an academic that you face those fears and you do what's right anyway. But that's where I've come closest to saying I'm just not going to touch it.
The other thing, when you ask the question, what I actually thought about is just the experience of writing or whatever people do. Once you do something that becomes a little bit public, and these days it's much easier to be, I mean, anybody can be a little bit public these days, which is in some ways great, but it's a dynamic that a lot of people aren't used to. Because once you're public, even if you're a 14-year-old kid who has some idea and you have a Twitter account or Facebook page and you put it out there, and, you see these firestorms, which even using that word is kind of often gets criticized because a firestorm was related to, real war. And now to turn that into a word that we talk about for controversies, that'll upset some people. So I think what we've learned is that in virtue of the books and the podcast being very public, a lot of people will criticize for all kinds of reasons, ideological reasons, opinion, something they just don't like. And I think what I've had to get used to, and I think what anybody has to get used to, is just if you make a public argument, of course there are going to be people who attack you or don't like it or misinterpret you or whatever. And I think it's really important to learn how to do that for everybody. And what I think is bad is a lot of people who start getting public. Let's say you're a young academic or a young journalist and you start doing something. And let's say you write something and most people read it and understand it and learn from it. But then, you know, half of 1% of the people get enraged about it and start to attack you and attack you personally. It's very natural and easy for you, the writer or whoever you are, to say, oh, God, I'm never going to say anything like that again because it's a little bit painful. And I think it's really important to understand that public criticism is the noise and it's not the signal. And it's really important to not be, you know, thrown off the course of what you want to think as a business person or an artist or whatever by the three noisy people out there who choose to assault you, and to recognize that kind of criticism for what it is. I got an MFA in writing years ago from Columbia, which was great experience. And the way it worked is there'd be one, you know, the professor was usually a novelist or nonfiction book writer, and 12 students, and you would each turn in a part of your manuscript every 3 or 4 weeks, whatever. Everybody would read it over the week and then come in and workshop it, right? So if you've never been through a writing workshop, it's like it gets incredibly vitriolic and personal. And you realize, so one thing I wanted to do but never did is just bring in a manuscript by one of the greatest writers of all time, whoever it was, that people wouldn't know. And you would see, and this is backed up by so much social science research and wine tasting and all kinds of things. If you label something in a certain way, people's perception of it will cause them to treat it one way. So if I bring in a piece of Tolstoy and say, hey, I'd like everybody to read this Tolstoy. Oh, my God. So the symbolism is so incredibly profound and all the kind of, you know, submerged occultism is fantastic. And then you bring in the same thing and say that I wrote it. And they're going to say, oh, my God, that is so pretentious. That symbolism is like such a joke. So you have to learn to sort out the criticism from what you think is relevant. And if you're going to make a public argument on radio or books or whatever, acknowledge that, you know, you work as hard as you can to work it out. And then you put it out to the public. People have a chance to respond, which is great because no one wants to be the dictator. And then, you know, live with it and move on and keep doing it. And I think that's a hard lesson to learn. But I think we've, you know, we've tried to do it at least.
Stephen Dubner is a journalist. Stephen Levitt is an economist. They are the two minds behind Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, and their latest book, Think Like a Freak, which is hilarious. And you guys do a very good job of making econ stories human. So thank you for that. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks so much,
Aaron. Thank you. Fun.